This is the Center for Strategic and International Studies Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. Welcome to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. I'm Beverly Kirk here at CSIS in Washington. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can find me at Beverly Kirk, and our Smart Women, Smart Power handle is at Smart Women. Gender equality is one of the United Nations' 17 Sustainable Development Goals. While the UN says progress is being made toward achieving that goal, there is still work to be done. In February, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson appointed a special envoy to lead the UK's efforts to ensure the rights of women and girls. And joining me now with more is Joanna Roper, the British government's special envoy for gender equality. And Joanna, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been a diplomat for a while, previously serving at the British Embassy in Beijing as acting director general for the Department of International Trade, and you also served in Tokyo and Islamabad. You worked on national security issues in London, and so you've had an incredibly exciting career.
Thank you. Yes, I have. It's been really fun, really good.
Women are half the world's population, relating directly to the job you're doing now as the special envoy for gender equality. Why is it that gender equality is so seemingly hard to achieve?
So I think that's a really, really interesting question, because if we had the answers, we'd probably either be very rich or very powerful. But I think the answer is that this is a long-term change that we're trying to affect. And certainly for the UK, our foreign secretary, our prime minister, the government recognises that gender equality is a really integral part of what we should be doing as a government. We took stock some months ago and we realised that there was a lot of work that was taking place across the British government, really, really good work. The programme and policy work that our Department for International Trade does, for example, the work that our Ministry of Defence does, our Home Office, Departments for Education, and the Government Equalities Office, as well as the Foreign Office. And for the foreign secretary, what he would like to see is a foreign policy that delivers consciously and consistently delivers for women and girls around the world. And so my appointment, which I took up in April, if you like, is that sort of embodiment of really trying to make sure that we have gender equality wrapped throughout our foreign policy, our defence policy, our security policy, our domestic policy as well. But in terms of the answer to your question, it is a long-term change. What we're trying to do, I think, is change environments, change social practices, change mindsets that hold women back and prevent women and girls from really achieving and having access to the same sorts of opportunities. That could be girls having access to education. It could be some of the practices that hold them back from economic empowerment or political participation. There's a whole raft of work that we're doing to try and see gender equality improve over time.
The Foreign Secretary specifically noted education being a particular concern, and I found this statistic to be really surprising. 61 million girls globally between the ages of 6 and 14 don't have access to school, and the UN says that girls still face barriers getting into both primary and secondary schools in a lot of parts of the world, such as sub-Saharan Africa, Western Asia, and Oceania. That seems so surprising in 2017 to read those kinds of statistics?
It's a shocking statistic, isn't it? When you think about the potential and, the lack of access that girls will have to education. For the UK, it's a really, really big fundamental part of what we do. And through UK aid, we're funding to see 11 million children between 2015 and 2020 to get access to schools and help them stay there. And that includes 6.5 million girls around the world. Because we know that if we educate girls and young women, it helps to alleviate some of the subsequent inequalities that they might see in later life. So, for example, we know that if you educate a girl, a young woman, she will marry later in life. She will have fewer children. Those children will be healthier. They themselves will go into schools, and they will have access to economic opportunity or sustainable livelihoods that they wouldn't otherwise have had. So it helps to break that poverty cycle. And I think it's a really important, if not a silver bullet, then it's certainly a real cornerstone of what we're trying to do.
And the UN says that educated women also contribute to a nation's economy in
Absolutely.
A major way.
Yes. And I think that's really important. I think if we're looking at economic empowerment around the world and the contribution that women can make, there was a McKinsey survey, a report that came out in September 2015, that said anything between $12 and $28 trillion could be added to the global economy by 2025 if women took a sort of an equivalent part in the global economy. And that's an economic argument that can't really be overlooked.
And speaking of McKinsey studies, there was a recent one that McKinsey did with Sheryl Sandberg's leanin.org group that had some surprising information, or at least it was surprising to me. It found that gender equality in the workplace may be slow or is slow, that it in fact may be stalling, and that some folks might be actually okay with lower numbers of women in senior leadership. That particular study, Sheryl wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal article, and it said that nearly 50% of men and nearly a third of women thought it was okay if just 1 in 10 senior leaders in their company is a woman. What do you make of that?
It's interesting, isn't it?
It is
and
interesting.
It's one way of describing it. I think in the UK, again, sort of looking at what I have sort of come across in the course of my job, what we've tried to do is really encourage a higher bar. We commissioned a couple of reports actually that looked into the number of women on boards in our top number of companies in the UK, and really try to set targets to see an increase in the number of women on boards. We know that if there are more women on boards, that their company tends to be more profitable and more of an attractive investment prospect for contacts and stakeholders, investors. So we want to see more women on boards, and we have managed to achieve that target. We're now looking at the next level down, the sort of the executive level, and again, setting targets to encourage companies to bring more women into that senior management role. And that's without quotas, that's without legislation, but it's incentivizing and motivating companies to recognize that this is the right thing to do. It's not just, sort of for women themselves, it actually makes economic sense for the companies too.
And that's a great example, but do you worry about people getting complacent on the issue of gender equality and thinking, oh, we have a certain number of women in these high positions? We get complacent because they are there, and we don't think necessarily about bringing more along.
I think you've put your finger on one of the issues there. I mean, women make up 50% of the population. Certainly in government, where I work, we want to have a government that is reflective of modern contemporary British society. That means doing more to bring women up through the different ranks, through the grades, into our senior structures as well. So on the government side, there's a huge amount that's taking place on diversity and inclusion in its broadest sense, as well as for gender equality specifically. Complacency, I don't know about that. I wonder if in conversations, you know, we're seeing much more in sort of media commentary and dialogue about gender equality, why it's important. I wonder, I think the report also talked about issues such as unconscious bias, for example. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's about challenging ourselves to just, you know, make sure that we're not unconsciously excluding a proportion of the population.
And the UK is doing something right, as you have alluded here. The recent European Institute for Gender Equality's Gender Equality Index ranks the UK 6th, just behind Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the Netherlands, and France. So what are you and the British government doing to share the best practices that you've just described?
I mean, it's great that we were six. I'd like to see us first, obviously. And I looked also at the World Economic Forum as well. We are 20 out of 144 countries in that index as well. And I think that's because we've had a really real commitment from government and business and an active civil society. We all work in partnership to make sure that we are really trying to make a difference. For example, something that's very topical is looking to close the gender pay gap in the UK. The pay gap at the moment is around about 18%. Organisations of 250 people or more have a year to assess their gender pay gap and publish that and tell us what they're doing to address that. So that will all come out by next April. So it'll be interesting to see some of the figures that come out there. But I think where we're trying to work together with other countries, how we share expertise, how we share our own knowledge and understanding of the issues, what the causes are and how we can address some of those issues. You know, that's why I travel around and talk to the Swedes and the Finns and the US. That's why I'm here, so we can talk and share our own understanding. And, you know, that's how we, you know, exchange best practice.
And how do you, are there projects or things that you're working on that you will take into parts of the world that perhaps don't have the gender equality figures that the UK has?
I think what I've tried to do in the last few months since taking on my role is come up with a structure that enables each of our, all of our embassies, our high commissions around the world, to be able to point to something within that strategy that says this is what we're doing on gender equality that's right and appropriate for the context that we're in the country that we're operating. Because gender equality takes on many, many different forms around the world, and so one model cannot possibly fit all. So what we've tried to come up with, I've come up with, is a three-pillar strategy. We want women and girls to be equal, we want them to be empowered, and we want them to be safe. And within those three pillars, every mission is able to point to say, this is what we're doing to fulfill that Foreign Secretary's, you know, desire to see that foreign policy delivering for women and girls that's appropriate to their context.
Would you call this a feminist foreign policy? I know that term, I believe it's the foreign minister of Sweden who talked about a feminist foreign policy regarding her country, but would you call what is being done in Britain a feminist foreign policy?
Well, we haven't put it in those terms. I mean, certainly Sweden is very upfront, has been talking about their feminist foreign policy from 2014, and we work closely with the Swedes. They have gone through what we are going through. We want to learn from them as well. But what it is really, as I say, sort of making sure that gender equality is wrapped into our thinking, into our policy and our programme work from the outset. So it's not an add-on. It's not something that people have to think about separately or pop in a box. It's integrated into our thinking from the outset. And that, I think, is a really important thing.
Do you think that's the better approach, where people just think of this as the norm, not something that you have to crack the whip and make people do?
I think there is a spectrum of understanding, and, you know, some people will get it straight away and understand why, you know, it's so important, and others maybe need a little bit more help or explanation or to understand the rationale as to why gender equality is not just the right thing to do, but actually it's the smart thing to do. And that, for me, is a big part of my job, is how I can go out and talk to our staff, our ambassadors, our contacts, and just explain why we're taking this approach, that weaving it in, integrating it into our thinking from the outset, actually helps people to deliver their security policy or their foreign policy or their trade policy, because it makes our policies more rounded, more comprehensive, and therefore more effective.
And you, earlier in the conversation, you made the economic argument for it. Is that the easiest argument to make when you're talking about this with other stakeholders?
I think it depends on what you're talking about. I mean, there's a very compelling moral case that, for example, honour killings, forced marriage, female genital mutilation are just not right. You know, they're just unacceptable practices that we want to try and eradicate over time, and work with partners, work with civil society to try and make that happen. At the other end of the spectrum, if you're talking about how to bring women how to improve women's economic empowerment, then having an economic argument really helps to reinforce that.
Well, I want to remind our listeners, you are listening to the Smart Women Smart Power podcast. I'm Beverly Kirk, and my guest today is Joanna Roper. She is Great Britain's Special Envoy for Gender Equality. Follow us on Twitter at Smart Women, and you can follow Joanna at Joanna Roper, FCO, and let me spell that for you. It's JoannaRoper, FCO. Do you tweet a lot?
I try and tweet regularly, yes, particularly if I'm traveling, just because it helps people to know what I'm doing, I think.
And do you think social media is an effective way of getting your message out?
I hope so.
To a different audience?
Yes. It's a very effective sort of quick snapshot of what we do. It's not the full picture, obviously, but if we're trying to engage and tell people what we're doing, then social media is very effective.
I want to talk about security and gender equality, and you worked on national security for several years, but related to the position that you're in now, what are some of the gender equality issues in security that we should maybe be thinking about a little more?
So I think that there's an overarching, if you like, UN Security Council 1325, which was adopted and has been signed up to, and that brings into everybody's consciousness the sort of issues of women within security resolution, peacekeeping, mediation. So we call it Hold the Pen. We lead on that at the United Nations. Hold the Pen, yes, we lead on it. It's just it's language, but it means that we lead on that at the UN. And we take that really seriously. It's something that we have a national action plan. All countries that have signed up to this have a national action plan. Ours is being refreshed at the moment. And that sets out how our government makes sort of has the commitments to ensure that women are integral to our peace and security efforts around the world. The National Action Plan is written with the Foreign Office, Department for International Development, and the Ministry of Defence. So it's a tri-departmental action plan, and we all have responsibilities for ensuring that it's carried out on the ground as well.
And I should note, you mentioned a national action plan. President Trump just recently signed into law the Women, Peace, and Security Act that is aimed at bolstering the role of women in peace negotiations and conflict resolution. It was a bipartisan bill that furthers the U.S. national plan on women, peace, and security with a goal of having women engaged in the process and protected as agents of peace and stability. Is there an issue with the need for more women to be in the role of peacekeepers around the globe?
I think that if we can see more women as peacekeepers, as well as sort of conflict mediators and resolution owners, then I think we see a much greater likelihood of, for example, peace resolutions being sustainable, being durable, and, you know, there's some very good data that backs that up. I think for peacekeeping operations, if we have women as part of those operations, then it brings a different dynamic to those operations on the ground. For the communities who have been affected by conflict, for example, having a series of women soldiers or peacekeeping operatives actually is reassuring. And it also means that if we're talking to women on the ground, we're engaging with the communities that have been affected. And that means itself that you get engagement and buy-in, and that's why those resolutions will last longer.
And perhaps you get people who are more willing to talk to a woman than perhaps a male soldier if there have been certain atrocities committed.
Exactly that, yes. Yeah. So for all of those reasons, that's why we think it's important. That's why it's fantastic that the US has signed this into the Act as well. And many countries around the world are also looking at their national action plans. And we work together on the ground as well. You know, there are collaborations around the world where countries can sort of work together to really see a difference.
Let me ask you about preventing sexual violence and human trafficking. Those are areas that you're specifically concerned with in your role. Talk about some of the concerns you have and whether these issues are getting enough attention.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, both of those issues are really important for the British government. Indeed, the Prime Minister made modern-day slavery a priority for her to the extent that she took to the UN General Assembly a call for action to try and bring countries together to try and address and tackle the causes and the impacts of modern-day slavery. And if we look at some of the figures from the ILO, for example, anything between 20 and 40 million men, women and children have been forced into labour. And these are phenomenal figures. 25% of those are children, and over 70% of those victims are women and girls. So yes, very much, this is a really important part of what I try to do to support that modern slavery campaign and that call for action. And on preventing sexual violence, you may recall a few years ago, our then Foreign Secretary, now Lord William Hague, and the UN Special Envoy for refugees, Angelina Jolie, launching our Preventing Sexual Violence initiative. And that's because we saw around the world hundreds of thousands of men and women and girls and boys having been subjected to sexual violence, and that was just unacceptable. So they launched the Preventing Sexual Violence Initiative, PSVI. We held a huge, enormous conference in 2014, which brought together an enormous number of governments and representatives and ministers and civil society and survivors, so we could really bring this to the consciousness, the sort of the world consciousness. And it hasn't stopped. We're still working on that. We have a Prime Minister's special representative in the form of Lord Ahmed, who's one of our Foreign Office ministers. And that is still remains a priority for us as well. And what we're trying to do is support the survivors of sexual violence to ensure that we are documenting where we can incidents of violence. We've sent out global principles around how we document and gather evidence. So as and when the time comes, when there is a judicial process in place, we are able to try to bring those perpetrators to account. And the current focus of the PSVI campaign is to try and address stigma that survivors face. So when they return to their communities, to their villages, they are often ostracised, they are unable to tap into sources of support, and we want to try and raise awareness and address the issues of stigma that survivors face around the world. And again, at the UN General Assembly last month in September, we launched the Global Principles for tackling and addressing stigma as well.
Do you think we talk enough about sexual violence as a part of conflict and war? I know there were the cases of the Boko Haram Chibok girls and the Yazidi women in Iraq. We hear about those cases, and it's so important to bring up the issue of what happens when people survive and how to help them. But do we focus on this issue as a provision of conflict enough?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, certainly what we're trying to do with partners and other governments as well, actually, is to really put survivors at the heart of our programme work, our support work, sort of supporting psychosocial support for those survivors who come back after that. And I think, you know, it's something that we need to be maintaining that momentum and that commitment on. And the UK government sees that very much as a priority.
Looking ahead, what are some of the specific projects or goals that you have in mind for the new role that you're in?
Well, I have high ambition and high appetite. And I think the challenge for me is to make sure that I'm working with the right people to really see change on the ground, because ultimately that's what we want to see. We want to see those gaps being closed, whether it's seeing more girls going into school and being able to stay there, whether it's seeing more young women having access to the facilities or the services that will enable them to have a sustainable livelihood, whether it's about encouraging young women to get involved in political participation at local or national level, whatever it is, making a difference on the ground is really, really important. Government has a role to play, without a doubt. We can't do it on our own. We know that as well, which is why working with other governments and with civil society and academics and communities and leaders, sort of community leaders and on the ground is really, really important. So an integrated approach, recognizing how we can really try and make a difference.
Well, this is fascinating work, and I'm so glad that you've chosen to spend time with the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. Joanna Roper, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you all for joining us. Remember to follow us on Twitter. I'm at Beverly Kirk. We're at Smart Women, and you can follow Joanna at Joanna Roper, FCO. Thanks for being here. Thank you for listening. For more information, go to csis.org and subscribe to our podcasts.